Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
First off, before we get into our main point of the day, which I think this is going to be a very important podcast, I just want to address some comments we got after our AI podcast. Someone said, or a bunch of people said, that basically to me and to my guest, Kevin Cerace, and to Jay, our producer, said, you're delusional if you think AI won't cost some jobs. Of course, AI is going to cost some jobs. That is not what we said in the podcast. It's just like when cars were introduced, you know, in the early 1900s, some people who rode horses lost their jobs. But eventually, there were many, many, many more jobs created in the auto industry than were lost in the, I don't know, horse industry. And did it happen overnight? Probably it did, actually. But who knows? Also, there were jobs lost. You know what jobs were lost? Jay, I bet you don't know this. A key job was lost, a key industry. People who shoveled manure in the streets of New York City lost their jobs. Because there used to be like a foot of manure at the end of every day in New York City because of all the horses crapping on the street, you know, driving Wall Street bankers around. You know, everybody lived, you know, the suburbs were the Upper West Side in New York City, and most people lived in Tribeca, and they worked in downtown, which was basically the Wall Street area. And just that number of people created like a foot of crap of horse manure in New York City every day. All those people lost their jobs. That industry disappeared. But again, the world was a better place for it, and many more jobs were created, and people were able to live outside of New York City and live in nice, bigger places with yards in the suburbs because it was easier to commute, you know, 20, 30, then 40 miles, and on and on. The benefits of every major innovation has outpaced the disadvantages. We'll talk about the movie Oppenheimer on another occasion. We'll bring on Brian Keating, our favorite physicist, and talk about that and help him prepare for his upcoming appearance on the Joe Rogan Show. But here's the problem. Here's the real problem. Why are people posting comments? Why don't people think? Why do people have opinions about AI and they don't really think, and they have opinions without really knowing anything about the industry? Listen to that episode. And we even say that the exact same thing I just said. Listen to the episode rather than just making an opinion and posting it on social media. And that's the problem we have right now. We're many of us, and I count myself in this category often, many of us are just miserable people looking for every day, looking for a scrap of an excuse to just keep on living. And that sounds kind of bleak, but we just sit there like thumbing through social media like, oh, I disagree with that person. I have to comment. I have to comment so that people see my comment and think about me and know who I am.
Yeah, they don't even like click into it and see it. They probably just see the headline and then just start commenting without reading the whole thing or listening to the whole thing.
Yeah, right. I might have mentioned this on the podcast with Kevin actually, but I was at this dinner a few weeks ago with a bunch of physicists, chemists, biologists, and also science writers, including one Pulitzer Prize winning physics writer. And I couldn't believe how negative they were about every technology. Like genomics or CRISPR, they were saying, is going to create a virus that's going to kill everybody on the planet. Forgetting the fact that it's already curing tons of diseases that people thought were incurable. And it's only at the beginning, it's only inning one of that. Or AI. Oh, these are physicists talking. AI, they're going to eventually hand over the ability to launch nuclear weapons to AI, and it's going to kill all of us because the AI is going to be self-aware and have emotions. Oh, that was another comment. Someone said that it's pretty clear AI is going to be self-aware. No, it's not pretty clear. It's just, when you boil it all down, it's just a bunch of statistics and really big computers crunched for a year and a half on a bunch of data and produced statistics, and that's what ChatGPT is. I'm summarizing that whole episode we did the other day in three lines. It's much more complicated than that, but...
Why did almost all scientists, so negative?
I don't know. And I said that, like, they were really critical of space tourism. You know, you could pay to go on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, for instance. And they say, oh, it's just a bunch of billionaires virtue signaling how much money they have. And I'm like, you know, I grew up on, like, the TV show Star Trek is a show about space tourism, right? They're not allowed they're exploring the final frontier and they're not allowed to change anything, right? They're just tourists. So we all grew up loving this show and movies that were basically about a bunch of space tourists, like Spock was a space tourist. And everybody should just relax because all of that sets the stage for mining minerals on the moon, for instance. Like the Earth could run out of rare earth minerals. They're rare for a reason, but the moon, they're not rare. And this, you know, powers our electric grid with stuff like that. And then this one woman who was a physics professor at a very prestigious institution, she says to me, because I was at the end of the dinner, I couldn't believe what I was hearing, so I finally said something. And then she says to me, well, what about all our knowledge? Aren't you worried that all our knowledge is now being stored in digital form and it could just with a switch could all disappear? And I'm like, A, everything is backed up a billion places. And B, the Library of Alexandria in like, what was it, 300 AD or BC? I don't know. It all burned down. That was all the knowledge of Western civilization up to that point. Like paper could disappear, but it's much harder for digital to disappear. Oh, but what if all electricity goes away? That's not going to happen. If all of electricity goes away, I'm not going to be worried about civilization's knowledge at that point. Like, oh, I have other things to worry about.
Also, like, if all electricity go away, I'm sure all the books in library at some point is going to erode. And then, you know, there's no more knowledge passed down. Even though if they carved it into a wall, no one know what they're talking about. And it's still going to, you know, the knowledge is going to lose.
By the way, it is the theme of quite a few science fiction novels where far in the future, and in fact, one series that was recently very popular, I won't give any spoilers, but it is the theme that in the future, after an apocalypse, we could lose all knowledge. But just think of the order of that. First comes apocalypse, then we lose knowledge. So we have other things to worry about if no one's going to flip a switch and destroy all knowledge. And by the way, it's all backed up. So presumably a future civilization, if they get technologically savvy, can restore the backup. That's like, right. like just like we figured out how to read hieroglyphics, somebody will be able to restore our backups.
It's probably easier to restore a backup than trying to figure out how to read a
yeah.
whatever.
Totally, know? Because you had to decode the whole thing. Like we didn't know for 1,000 years. We didn't know how, or 2,000 years. We didn't know how to decode hieroglyphics. We had to figure out the code, literally. We had to debug it. So, but anyway, the point I'm trying to make is going to segue into this podcast, which is there's a solution to all of this angst and worry and anxiety, pessimism and cynicism. It's, you know, stop thinking about other people, which is hard in our society because of social media. Other people are like, you wake up in the morning and you just start doom scrolling on Twitter or, you know, Threads or Instagram, whatever it is. Everybody's so, and I'm like this, everybody's so concerned with what is everyone else doing? I'm just lying in bed scrolling like on Twitter, but what is everyone else doing? They're all doing something while I'm lying in bed and they're all have a, and I, maybe I can have an opinion on something. So I better scroll and plan with me. Here's a solution. And this has really helped me throughout my entire life. It has helped me when I've been broke after having money. It has helped me come back from being broke and you know, make money again. It has helped me when I've been depressed about things not going well with career or whatever. This is since I was a kid practically. And I'm going to simplify it and explain. Go on a quest. And I'll describe what I mean in a second, but I've done this my entire life. And I'll give you an example. This is a personal example, but I will give it anyway. One time, this was like like early 1996 or no, late 1995. I had this girl I was dating and she was really smart, but I don't know, she was an angry person. We weren't quite clicking but we were dating. And one time I stay over and she, you know, this is just too much information, but couldn't really, you know, I was a young guy, 1995, but I wasn't really that attracted to her. So things didn't happen. And she's like, ugh, you disgust me. And she threw me out of her apartment. And it's 3 a.m. and in the East Village in New York City. And I walk on like a Tuesday night and I walk outside and the streets are packed. And I'm thinking to myself, I've got to wake up in a few hours to go to work. Like, and I wasn't making any money. My salary at the time was not enough to live in New York City. I had to make my way all the way back to wherever I lived. And it was, what are all these people doing? How can they afford to do this? Don't they have to work in the morning or don't they have to go to school in the morning? Everybody was just out having, it was like one giant party on a Tuesday night at 3 a.m. So I went on a quest and it changed my life. It literally made me millions of dollars, which I then proceeded to lose afterwards. But the quest was, I want to find out what I'm an early sleep. I go to bed early. I want to find out, I did all my life. I want to find out what people are doing. Why are people up at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night? I just wanted to know. I had no idea. I didn't have any even guesses what all these, why the streets were packed at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night. I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. and it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
What makes you at that point, what feeling do you have when you're like, okay, now I'm on the quest, now I want to do a quest?
Well, I was insanely curious. And I was kind of even a little bit jealous. Like, I had this 9-to-5 cubicle life. And yeah, I had a fun job. I worked at HBO, which is a fun place. I admired the company. But I had this cubicle life. I had cubicle problems. Like, oh, the person in the cubicle next to me was talking too loud, or if my boss was upset at me, you know, I lived and breathed on what other people thought about me. And of course, now my girlfriend at the time hated me, or was disgusted with me, I should say. I don't know if she quite hated me, but definitely was disgusted. Let me just say, by the way, I really like this person, but she was the type of person literally would be walking in the street and like homeless people would just go up to her and spit in her face. Like, she was likable person. She just exuded unlikability. She was like, her face was twisted in anger all the time.
Why? Okay, so she has what we call a resting bitch face then.
Yes, I suppose you would call that, but men could have that too. I just want to add. So, but she really had it because she was also super smart. So she had like, her thoughts were always angry. But she was so funny because of that I was attracted to her humor and so on. But anyway, the point is, I got insanely curious because I was maybe a little jealous. Like, what is it about these people's lives that allowed them to basically, you know, have a great time at 3 a.m. when I was just a nervous wreck all the time, and I had to be asleep at 3 a.m. if I wanted to go to work the next day and do well at my job. I wanted to do well at my job. I was afraid of getting fired, and then I would have zero money. I lived paycheck to paycheck, and if I got fired from what I thought was the best thing that ever happened to me, I don't know what I would do. So how are I really wanted to understand, not only for curiosity, because I was curious about them, but because I was curious about me. Like, how could I potentially live the sort of life where it doesn't matter if I'm out at 11 in the morning or 3 a.m. or whatever. Like, these people seem to have a certain freedom that I didn't have. And so it became my quest to find out what these people were doing. So at the time, I was in charge of HBO's website. HBO didn't have a website. This was 1995. They had just bought HBO.com from HomeBoxOffice.com. I mean, they bought it from a company called HBO & Company, but previously they were homeboxoffice.com. And so they bought HBO.com for, guess how much? I think you already know anyway.
$25,000?
$250,000 back in 1995.
So how much would it worth right now? Including all the millions? Like with all the...
Oh, if you wanted to buy HBO.com. Well, no, maybe not anymore because they changed their brand name to Max. So let's say
if they were to buy HBO then. So if they were called a home box office the whole time, and then tomorrow they're like, I want to buy HBO.com. How much would they pay for it?
Probably like 5 to 10 million.
Really? Is that how much the three-letter domain costs right now?
First off, it's a three-letter domain. All three-letter domains are probably at least $1 million.
Oh.
And on top of it, it's the brand.
Right.
One of the most powerful brands in the United States, if not the world. So it would be whoever sat on that domain would be very rich. But
yes,
I don't even know why they were so insightful to buy HBO.com. I mean, I was really pushing the web. When I first got there, they didn't want to do a website at all. They thought it was just a waste of time. It's something that academics play with, and forget this internet stuff. So maybe it was me shaking the tree that got them to buy HBO.com.
Do you propose them to buy HBO.com, or did they just buy it themselves?
I did not, but I did tell... I mean, it was basically the CEO who had decided, who later became the CEO of Time Warner, Jeff Bukas. Really, I think he was a really... As far as measuring the success of a CEO, he was a very brilliant guy and did a very good job, not only for HBO, but later on for Time Warner, particularly when Time Warner was trying to absorb the devastating mistake of buying AOL. He became the CEO after they bought AOL and fixed the situation. And of course, recently he retired when HBO got bought by, I don't know, some phone company for, not HBO, but Time Warner got acquired by some phone company. I forget, Verizon or
AT&T, I think.
AT&T, yeah, for like, I don't know, hundreds of billions. I don't know the exact number.
It must be a time travel that like, hey, you have to buy HBO.
I don't know. I mean, I'm glad they did it. But the point is, I was in charge of HBO.com at the time. Nobody knew what to do with it. And so I went up to Jeff Bukas. And by the way, it was very inappropriate that I did this. But again, I'll describe something else. I was on this quest. I needed to find out what was going on at 3 a.m. And it seemed like also I could do it. I could go on this quest as part of my job. Now, technically my job, my title was junior programmer analyst in the IT department. So that was my job. But somehow I figured I could figure out a way to make it my job to combine my job with this quest, to find out what is going on at 3 a.m. in a city like New York City. So the first thing I did was I went to Comedy Central. So I went to the Comedy Central IT department. And Comedy Central at that time, just so you know, was half owned by HBO.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah. So I think Showtime owned the other half, you know, or Viacom owned the other half. So I was friends with the head of IT at Comedy Central because I was in IT at HBO. She asked for my help to build. Nobody had intranets then, you know, like an internal internet. So I had built one for HBO, and I'm visiting Comedy Central, and she's asking me to help them build their internal network, their intranet. And I said, I will do it, but I want one thing. I want the 3 a.m. time slot, because you run ads at 3 a.m. Like, they didn't really have any TV shows at 3 a.m. Comedy Central. I don't know if they do now. They just ran ads, like infomercials. And I said, I want the 3 a.m. time slot. I'm going to just live ask people, what do you do at 3 a.m.? What are you doing at 3 in the morning in New York City? By the way, this would be an enormous TikTok channel now. Like, there's that guy who walks around New York City like, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a producer of a podcast. What's the favorite thing you like about your job? Oh, talking to people. That's what's up. You know that guy?
I know, yeah. And also the other guy is like, you go around like, oh, what do you, how much is your rent? Can I tour your home?
Oh, yeah, there's that guy. And there's the same guy does that in Dubai also. And he's always going in like these sheik's apartments. Can we get that Das What's Up guy on the podcast?
Yeah, I can look it up.
Yeah. So anyway, so she said, okay, I'll find out if I can do this. So she asked the CEO of Comedy Central, a guy named Doug Herzog at the time, she asked the CEO of Comedy Central if I could do this, and he said, no way. Meanwhile, fast forward a couple years later, they did a show with Dave Attell called Insomniac about what people do in the middle of the night in New York City.
Wait, do you not sue them?
No, it's all good. It's all good. But meanwhile, I went up to, at some Christmas party at HBO, I went up to the CEO. So just to put into context, my boss's boss was the CEO of HBO.
Holy shit.
So I went over the heads of all my bosses, the six bosses in between, and I went to Jeff Bugis and I said, hey, just like HBO has this great original TV shows like Sex and the City, and you know, later on it would be The Sopranos and other shows, let's do original web shows. Let's make web entertainment, and let's make that HBO.com is not just a marketing pamphlet for our shows. And he said, you know what? I don't give a shit. Do whatever you want. I don't care. And so I went back to my boss and I said, I just spoke to Jeff Bugis. And he said, what? And I said, I just spoke to the CEO. And he said, why'd you go above my head? He was very upset. But I said, look, I'm sorry, I'll bring you next time. But he said, I have to do original web shows. He said he really wants original web shows for HBO.com. And he's like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, here's an idea. And I said, how about I go around the city at 3 a.m. and ask people what they do? What are they doing up at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night or Wednesday? Saturday night or Friday night, no problem. They don't have to work the next day. They're out at a bar, whatever. But why are they out on a Wednesday night? Don't they have to work? Or what is it about their lives that allows them to be out at 3 a.m? And so finally, everyone agreed for me doing this. And I got a video guy. I got a photographer. HBO made me bring a security guy for a while, but eventually I got rid of that guy. I had a production assistant who we had to get release forms signed by everybody. And I would go out. We would meet at around 2 a.m. or 2:30 a.m. in the East Village or the Meatpacking District or some of these seedy areas. They're not seedy anymore, but back then they were seedy. Right. This is 1996.
Wait, what is seedy?
What
about a CD?
You know, in the Meatpacking District now is like all fancy with clubs.
Right.
Back then it was all prostitutes.
Oh, so that's the term.
It was 100% prostitutes and Johns. And literally it was called the Meatpacking District because there were meat processing plants right there. And so there would be like these weird fires of meat burning on the sidewalk. Oh, and then there would be these prostitutes walking around and the Johns and the pimps and all that stuff. And the Lower East Side was all like homeless people and, you know, kind of people living in, there was like squatting in rundown, abandoned apartment buildings, or there were underground radio stations, or there was drug dealers. I went all over the city at 3 a.m. because I did this. So I ended up doing this from 1996 to mid 1998.
Oh, what? 2.5 years.
Yeah, it was the best experience. Like every Wednesday night, go out, and from 2 a.m. till about 4:30 a.m., I would just go up to people and I'll say, hey, what are you doing? What are you up to? What are you up to at 3 a.m? And invariably, nobody was up to anything good. Like, I would just talk to random people, and almost every single Wednesday, I talked to at least, just by coincidence, like at least one dominatrix, like who's like a prostitute that satisfies a particular fetish of men wanting to be beaten up or whatever. I would certainly run into like drug dealers or pimps or their customers, talk to homeless people, talk to people, you know, cheating on their spouses. I would sometimes, after a while, I lived in the Chelsea Hotel, which is you could Google it. It was a weird sort of place. Sometimes I would just sit in the lobby there and wait for people to come in and say, why are you out at 3 a.m? And nobody was up to anything good. And most people would lie to me. And it was just crazy. I ran into like one person I knew and I'm like, oh, what are you doing out here? And I knew him. His name was Luke. And he wouldn't say, but it was pretty clear there was an older man next to him. It was like he was a male prostitute, and I didn't know that about him. But so just, I would, and then I started running into the same people over and over. There was a kind of person who only was out in the middle of the night, and they would never be out during the day. So there was a whole different culture and subcultures at 3 a.m. It was like the opposite of what happens during the day. There was nobody in suits going to work. It was all just these random people living these alternative lifestyles. Some of them were very happy. Some of them weren't so happy. I did one time, I did the bus stop. There's one bus stop where there's a bus 24 hours a day that takes people to Rikers Island, which is a jail. It's an island right outside of Queens that is a jail. And the law is if you're bailed out, no matter what time it is, you could get bailed out and picked up. And people would take this bus back and forth, like their parents or their siblings or their friends would take the bus to bail them out. And then they would come back on the bus. And at the bus stop would be all of their, you know, the pimps and the prostitutes and the drug dealers, because it was their customers coming back from Rikers Island. And we spent like a month just interviewing everybody, gathering information. And that was actually, we turned that into kind of a pilot of a TV show, and it was really just beautiful.
Wait, what is it called? What is the TV show called?
3 a.m. The whole project was called 3 a.m.
Right, okay. No, I thought the pilot was for another show.
No. We had a budget, because eventually what happened was is that Sheila Evans, who's been on this podcast, she wanted to replace the show Real Sex, which was a very popular show on HBO, and she thought maybe 3 a.m. would be a replacement. And we did that segment, and she loved it. She paid for me to have a real producer, a real cameraman, and she loved it. But then we did a segment that wasn't as good. She didn't love it, and I left HBO to start a business. But, you know, the whole point is that me going on this quest led to such an exciting experience in my life. And also it led to other companies approaching me and saying, hey, can you do something really creative for us? Like American Express came to me, Con Edison came to me, every record label came to me, other movie studios came to me. So I was able to start a company, my first company, Reset. I left HBO ultimately and started a company making websites mostly for entertainment companies. But we also did AmericanExpress.com, ConEdison.com. I had never had any money in my life, and suddenly I had this business because of this quest that I went on to find out what people were up to at 3 a.m. Like, I wanted to know for me. I wasn't judging anybody. I didn't have any opinions. And I think that's why people spoke to me, is because I just was really innocently curious. I mean, I would interrupt couples while they were arguing. Like, what are you guys arguing about? Oh, I found some girl's phone number in his pocket. And the guy's like, I don't even know who that is. And, you know, some BS.
Is there any good story come up from it? Like you said, 3 a.m, everyone up to no good. Any good story that you like, heartfelt story from that?
Oh, yeah, many, many. I mean, there were people who were just, you know, mentally ill and struggling to survive, and they couldn't get jobs in the day, and they lived on, you know, welfare, and they were addicted to heroin, and this was their culture, their subculture was being out at 3 a.m. And I got to know a lot of these people. But I'll tell you one story that was a crazy story. Interrupt me if I've told this on the podcast before. But at 4 a.m., we would stop for the day, and we'd go to the Empire Diner for just to kind of finish off the evening. And it's 4 a.m, Empire Diner was on 11th Avenue and 22nd Street. And the waitress always knew who we were, and she always helped us out. She said, oh, check out this table at the other end there. And so it looked like a bunch of guys and girls celebrating. And I went over to them, and I'm like, what are you guys celebrating about? And this one guy with a British accent, he says, well, this lovely lady and I just got engaged. And I'm just, you know, we had the cameras on. My video guy always had his camera on. And I'm like, oh, I don't believe it. Prove it. Kiss each other. And so he grabs the girl and they start like making out. And I only found out later, like, you know, after we had been talking for like 20 minutes after that, they did not know each other at all. They were like, they hadn't even spoken ever. And they had just met. And that was the first time they ever said anything to each other, was they just started making out. And then about a year later, I ran into somebody who was sitting at that table and said, hey, you're the guy, you're that 3 a.m. guy. And he said, I was at the Empire Diner that one time and you got my friend kissing that girl. He was actually engaged to another girl in England. He broke up with that girl, and the girl who he kissed moved with him to England, and they were living together and dating for a while, and then they just broke up. And he said, but that was all because you got them to kiss. You like either helped their lives or ruined their lives forever.
Yeah, well, because for all you know, he could be in a very happy engagement that because of you, he kissed another girl, ended up breaking up that happy engagement.
Well, let's put it this way. It couldn't have been that happy an engagement if with 1 second notice he's willing to make out with another girl.
Yeah, you're right.
So chances are that marriage would not have worked out. So at the very least, I helped the girl he had previously been engaged to.
Yes. She should write to you and thank you. If she's listening to the podcast.
If she's listening, I'm the reason your fiance kissed that random girl. Ooh, oddly, I remember one detail. I can't remember what she looked like. I remember she worked at Microsoft. Like, I do remember that. She was like a sales rep at Microsoft. And so there were, but I had lots of stories like that. It was like, I was like the first podcaster on the internet. I was basically interviewing people and then putting the interviews on the World Wide Web, just like we do with this podcast. Now, I wouldn't put the audio because there wasn't bandwidth.
Right.
But I would put photos. And then here's what I did. I didn't have designers to design everything. And if you look at 1990s web design, it was a little overdone. There was too much design. Mm-hmm. Now things are much more minimal and simple, which I like better. But I would basically open it up to the web design community, like, and allow designers to compete with each other to design the pages that each interview was on. So each interview, I would do 4 interviews a week, and each interview was designed differently. And then we'd put photos. And every once in a while, we'd put video, but it was hard to, there was no streaming of the video. It was hard to download the video.
Do you accidentally create 99 Design? You know 99design.com, right? They put a request out and then they have people compete to design for a website or a cover.
Right. That's what I did, basically.
So you accidentally created 99 Design.
Right. I wish I had any business sense at all because it would have really worked out for it. Like I did so many things in the 90s that could have made me a lot of money, but I knew nothing about business. Like that's a whole another topic is it's not just about creating a great product and making a profitable business. You really have to know what business means in order to make money. You can't just sell things and make money.
Right.
You have to know what are the different types of businesses, how people value businesses, how to structure a business, how to scale a business. Like there's all these subtleties that I had no clue about, how to describe your business so that it is worth more than if you describe it a different way. But anyway, that's another topic. Yep. But I'm just describing this as this gave my life, like I was really depressed at HBO actually at first because I was working in this cubicle. I was working on this stuff, this programming that was really awful. And I didn't even know how to program. Like I've gone to undergrad for computer science and grad school for computer science. And I was such a bad programmer after all this quote unquote education. They had to send me to remedial classes on programming. And I thought I was going to get fired. And just going on this quest not only made me so much happier at work, and it also made me kind of known within the company. Like I was this 3 a.m. guy. So I was starting to get promoted. I was getting other offers and using that to get higher and higher salary. But then it even led to me starting a business. Like it changed my life. And it gave me this whole, I must have interviewed thousands of people. You know, for 2.5 years, I would interview about 20 people a week or 15 to 20 people a week and then put 4 interviews, the best 4 up every week. And so, I don't know, I must have interviewed at least like 1,000 people. So I got my interview skills and I learned so much about other people. And about also making a great website. So it gave me this going on a quest allowed me to not focus on my own problems, but actually I felt this pleasure of like, you know, it was difficult too because I was shy. How do you just go up to people in the middle of the night and say, hey, tell me what you're doing? So it helped me overcome shyness. It helped me get people talking and help me, you know, it gave me a lot of skills, and then it gave me, you know, things to look forward to and a different perspective on life. So it changed my life completely. Just being curious and then going on a quest. And you know, another quest was like when I did stand-up comedy. Like I was just curious. Like I always was curious, like how do these people make people laugh from stage? Like I'm funny at a party or whatever, but then making people, strangers, laugh from a stage, that's hard. How do people do it? So that was a 7-year quest that led to me buying part of a comedy club and going up on stage, you know, almost 7 days a week and traveling around the world. I mean, I went to, you know, I traveled with Tony Woods, one of the greatest comedians ever. He was just on Joe Rogan. Traveled with Tony Woods all over the world doing comedy. And that was a quest. Or, you know, more recently, you know, I was having kind of a down period after that New York City article came out, and I went on a quest again, which was to take just back off from social media, where I was getting death threats every half second, and take this childhood love of mine, which was, you know, I was a chess master when I was much younger, still am, because the title's forever, but I wanted to get back to my old skills in chess. And this quest has been amazing. Like I've gone to Norway and had dinner with the world chess champion. I've traveled all over the place playing chess. I'm the Georgia senior chess champion, about to compete in the US senior championship. And all these friends from 25 years ago, I'm meeting them, and I don't know, the quest is still ongoing, but it's been a life-changing experience. Also understanding the effects of aging on my brain and how to fix those, you know, things that are happening and be a better person for it. Like this whole experience, the quest is, again, still ongoing, but it's made me eat better, exercise better, sleep better, deal with loss better, deal with social media better, sharpen my brain, I've taken lessons from the world memory champion. So this has been a quest that's been life-changing. I wanted to talk about like, what is a quest? Like when you think of a quest, what do you think of, Jay?
Well, it's funny. It's like I was about to ask you, what's the difference between quests and purposes and missions, right? So for me, I felt like, you know, quest, it's someone that gives you the quest. So let's say if you're in a story, let's say your whole life is a story. The quest is all of a sudden the world is ending, and then an old bearded Kung Fu master just show up in front of you and be like, hey, you have the potential. Here's your quest to save the world.
Well, you still have to, remember, you still have to choose to go on the quest.
Yes.
Like Luke Skywalker didn't want to leave Tatooine at first. He had to, even after Obi-Wan Kenobi told him everything, he's like, I got to wait one more season because I promised my uncle.
Right.
And it was only the uncle getting killed by stormtroopers that Luke finally went on his quest, which was to learn about the Force and save Princess Leia and destroy the Death Star and on and on. He did not want to do it at first.
Right.
You have to choose to go on the quest. Your curiosity has to be, and here's the difference between a quest and a mission. A mission, you know what's going to happen. I'm going to do this. I'm going to spread malaria nets, mosquito nets to all the people in Africa. That's my mission, and I'm going to do it and save Africa from malaria. That's my mission. Or I'm going to teach people about leadership. So I'm going to write a book about everything I've learned about leadership, and that's my mission. A mission is almost kind of arrogant. Like the idea that you know you can do something and you're God put you down on this earth to do this purpose or mission. I don't really believe in those. A quest is you don't know what's going to happen. Luke Skywalker wanted to save the princess. He didn't know if he believed in the Force, but he was ready for adventure, excitement. He had nothing left on Tatooine. He was ready to go on his quest. A quest is more like a nonfiction arc of the hero, almost. Whereas a mission is like an arrogant, like, oh, this is my purpose. I have a purpose that the overlords implanted in me, and that this is what my DNA is forcing me to do.
Would you say mission has an end goal that you gotta achieve, or has a end goal target that you can see? Whereas quest is more like the, it's more about the journey. It's more about let's do this. And
it's
see
about both, but because look, a famous quest in fictional history is the Knights of the Round Table for King Arthur. They had to find something called the Holy Grail.
Holy Grail.
And they never actually found the Holy Grail. They never found it. So the quest didn't work. Or it did work because all of the stories and adventures around King Arthur are because of this quest. So yes, the journey is really important. And, you know, I've been thinking like, what are the components of that journey? First off, the quest is for you. There's something personal you have to find out about yourself when you go on this quest. Like, again, Luke Skywalker, he had to discover the Force within himself. Or me with this chess thing, I had to figure out, you know, what I had to realize I'm no longer as good as I was when I was younger. And and there's some things I can't get good at anymore, like my memory is different, or my calculation ability is different, or my ability to stay up all night and then play well the next day, that ability is gone. So I have to figure out things about myself, you know, as part of this journey. And so there's all these challenges. There's like a mission doesn't necessarily have challenges. I have challenges. Like my first tournament back, I lost something like 7 out of 8 games. And these are obstacles. These are real obstacles. And then I have to find, like in the Arc of the Hero, I have to find allies, people to help me. So I had to find coaches, and I had to find people who are my level to exchange ideas and notes. I had to find people who were going through the same thing I was, like older people maybe who were trying to play. And most people told me I was delusional. So, you know, along with these obstacles and these allies, there's also villains and people who are antagonistic to me. They're trying to stop me from doing my quest. And so then you go on the journey, and the journey has trials like, oh, I'm going to play in this tournament. Oh, I lost this tournament. And then I lost this other one. And then, oh, I've got to somehow get to Norway to have dinner with the world chess champion, and on and on. There's a journey, and adventures happen. And then you transform. Hopefully you transform and you have growth, like so that, oh, I realize I need to sleep better, or I need to eat a little better, never drink alcohol, and instead of wasting time on social media, I'll study some more positions to get ready for the next tournament. And so I grow and transform, and I sacrifice. So I sacrifice social media, or sometimes you have to sacrifice things that are important to you. Like, oh, I haven't been writing as much, or I might not, you know, spend as much time with this person so I can spend time doing this. And ultimately, you hopefully achieve the goal of the quest, and then you return to tell the tale. But that altogether is a quest. And I encourage people, don't just live that cubicle life. Don't just be, or even if you're not living the cubicle life, let's say you don't have a job, but you're feeling down or depressed, or let's say your relationships aren't quite working for you at the moment, find what is it you're insanely curious about, or what is it that you were curious about when you were younger, and test the waters, begin this quest. What do I need to do? What does this journey look like for me to achieve a certain goal? Maybe you want to write your first novel. Maybe you want to go to a yoga retreat in India and become a yoga teacher. Maybe you want to start your first business. You know, what do you think? You're going to be wrong, by the way. But what do you think are the steps you need to take? And take that first step. I find a lot of people, they want to write that first novel, and they go out at night with their friends every night and eat dinner and drink and have fun. And they're always saying, I'm going to write that novel. This year, I'm going to write it. But they never do it. Like, figure out, what is the first step? What's the second step? Take those steps. Assume there's going to be obstacles along the way, because you're not, the whole reason you're not at the goal, it's because you never did it. You don't know what to do. You don't know the things that are in between starting the quest and ending the quest. Luke Skywalker didn't know he'd have to learn the Force. He didn't know he'd have to save the princess in the Death Star, in the most lethal weapon ever created. And assume some people, find the people who will help you, like the Han Solos and Obi-Wan Kenobis, or in my case, chess coaches, chess allies, you know, the really gracious people who have allowed me to write for them at Nguyen Chess and other places. And these are your helpers and allies. There's going to be villains, the people who tell me I'm delusional, or the people who, you know, make fun of me, whatever. Or it could even be people who you know very well who are very skeptical. And now you begin the journey and have those trials and see the growth and make the sacrifices and you change as a person. It could be as the quest sounds, it doesn't even matter what the quest is. It could be as dumb as trying to get better at chess, or it could be, I want to make $1 billion. Although I will tell you, whenever I thought I was on a quest to make money was probably the most unhappy time of my life, because
I mean, I'm just curious, like, you know, like just find quests and stuff like that. But like, how do you know you found the right quest? Like my quest is I want to win a Grammy. I'm like, okay. And then I was working in a studio and then now I'm in podcasting. I'm like, am I still on track to win a Grammy? You know what I mean?
Well, this is a great question, Jay. And the truth is you don't really know. Nobody's going to come down and tell you, oh, Jay, you have found the right quest for yourself. You have, you know, just that's why it's so much BS where people are like, oh, this is my purpose. This is my mission. You just don't know. And by the way, you might halfway through the quest, it might be so frustrating. The challenges might be so great. You give up, and that's okay too. Again, this is where the journey is very important. It's not the only thing that's important. I don't believe when people say it's not the goal, it's the journey. It's both. The goal is very important, but the journey is just as important. And so if you feel like quitting a quest and starting a new one, then do it. But if you truly, let's say you have a, like for me, if I have a horrible tournament, I think to myself, oh, that's it. I quit. This is too painful. I'm not getting there. I'm not going to do it. And so on. But then the next day, if you wake up and you find yourself, huh, what's the next step? Like, it's because you love this quest so much. It's not even like I have fun that sometimes playing in these tournaments, particularly when I'm losing. But if I love the quest so much that the next day after I hit one of these obstacles, I'm still waking up with just as much energy. Or maybe it's not the next day. Maybe it's the next week. I'm waking up with just as much energy to keep pursuing the quest. Then you just stick with it. You let your body and your emotions tell you to stick with it. And you're going to feel like quitting sometimes too. And that's maybe times when you need to take a break because you can get overloaded.
So are you saying that, so if you feel like you're quitting, should just take a nap because you are cranky? No, I'm just joking. When you feel like you want to quit, you should take a day off, just sleep it off and see how you feel the next day.
Yeah, or take a few days off. Sometimes I'll take 3 or 4 days off from studying or interacting with people or playing or whatever. But you know what's been great for me is that it got me off social media. It got me to eat better. It got me to improve my memory. It got me to work hard at something again. I had forgotten what it was like to really, you know, the podcast is hard. The podcast is a lot of work, and other things I do are a lot of work. But this is like performing brain surgery on myself every day to get better at chess, particularly at this age. But I won the Georgia Senior Championship for people over 50. I'm about to play in the U.S. Senior Championship in a few days. And it's been difficult and it's been excruciating sometimes, but it's also been extremely fun and pleasurable. And I've learned so much about myself. And it got me away from just the mire that I was being sucked into from that old article I wrote and from some other things that were happening to me at the time. Like I had a kind of a negative period in like late 2020, early 2021. And I just wasn't showing up for things. And a quest is something you show up for and you're proud of it and you love it and you pursue it. And it's not always fun, but it's the pursuit is worth it. And that's really the thing. Now for you, if it's your quest to win a Grammy, well, what is the next step? But here's the thing. You can experiment with lots of things. Like at the end of 2020, there were lots of things I was experimenting with. Chess was just one of them. But there were others too. Like I was, trying to start different internet businesses, as you remember. Yep. I got really into betting on the election in 2020. So I was really getting into, we had the guys from Predicted on. I was really getting into event betting.
And you were into presidential too.
Yeah, I started running for president, and I thought I was going to take that really seriously, but it ended up being more of a joke. And this is the thing that survived. You experiment with a bunch of different quests, and this is the thing that survived. So again, what's a quest? Quest is the first half of question. So it starts with you being really insanely curious about something where you really don't know the answer. And then what would it take for you to know that answer? What is the goal? How would you know the answer? Well, for me, if I reach a certain level, I think that will be the objective of this quest. We'll see. And then just prepare. What challenges and obstacles might you experience? Well, you're not going to know all of them, but start going down the path and start having challenges. And then you find your allies to help you through these challenges. And then you find the people who are going to dissuade you or be against you on this quest. And you're going to be on the journey and have your trials and adventures. And then through this process, you're going to transform, grow, sacrifice, and hopefully get fully to the other side of the quest or not. It's enough to just simply have the experience, but hopefully you achieve the objective of your quest.
Yeah. You know, you always said like, who are you, why are you, and why now? Do you think those three questions would be able to apply to the quest?
Yeah. Like for instance, who am I? I'm someone who's always loved games and loved the challenges of competitive games, games like a chess or, you know, other games that fall under that category might be poker or Scrabble or checkers or backgammon. So I've always loved those. I'm always a game player. Even day trading has kind of like a game. So why am I? I'm someone who at the time, at particular in like late 2020, early 2021 or mid 2021, I was kind of depressed for a lot of reasons. Not hugely depressed, but you know, I was getting a lot of backlash from that article still, like even a year later. I had two books that came out and they were good books. Skip the Line was my favorite book I've ever written, but it didn't quite get the reception I would have liked. I had moved, I was having some trouble making new friends and I was worried about, you know, am I getting too old to pursue the things I love doing? And the why, that solved the why now, which is like, okay, I'm in my 50s and now if I'm going to do this, now's the time to do it, to get back to my old level. And particularly after the TV show The Queen's Gambit came out, it reminded me of my love for the game and I started pursuing it. So that was the why now. So who are you, why are you, and why now are critical questions for this. And also the plus minus equals technique that I describe in Skip the Line. You know, you have an objective, find a coach, that's your plus. Find people you can teach, that's your minus, because you don't truly understand something unless you can explain it simply. And find your equals, people who are on the same quest as you, so you can exchange notes and learn from each other.
Mm, that's great. I feel like that should be the next book you write.
Maybe I already wrote it though, Skip the Line, but we'll see. But I am, you know, Robert Greene, when on the podcast, when we had Robert Greene, author of Mastery and 48 Laws of Power, he said, oh my God, you have to write the book on this. And that kind of also kicked me off on the quest, was his encouragement, right? You were listening.
And so you do need some sort of validations halfway through.
Yeah, you definitely need validation somehow. Like if I only lost, I would not be pursuing it at this point. Like that would be too hard. But I've got trophies in the room along the way. So, you know, that's been good. But I also have to say, a quest can also ruin your life too.
How so?
Like every quest I've had has completely 100% changed my life. So this 3 a.m. thing, I ended up leaving corporate America and starting a business. Mm-hmm. This chess thing, you know, I haven't been writing as much. It's distanced me from certain friends or family, you know, or work. I could have been starting a business instead of playing a board game, you know, the past year or so. So it's really, it messes you up a little bit too. And it screws up your life in a big way. Sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. But transform is not always a positive thing. You're going to transform. Some of it's going to be negative. Hopefully more of it will be positive. So I think we should title this episode actually, you know, how to screw up your life with a quest.
How to ruin your life with a quest.
How to ruin your life with a quest. So, because maybe I will ruin my life with this, but we'll see.